Hello and welcome to Intrepid Heroes Presents, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. I'm John Godek, and with me today is Jason Tondreau. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a real privilege to be here.
So Jason, who happens to go by Jake here at Paizo, because apparently they have quite a few other Jasons, is a developer and freelance author for Paizo. Jake, you had a somewhat circuitous path to becoming a developer here at Paizo, including a stint as an English professor. Can you tell us a little bit about this journey?
Sure, absolutely. I took my PhD at the University of California, Riverside, in about 2008 was when I finished that. And I spent several years sort of part-time adjuncting. If anyone out there is in academia, you know what I mean by adjuncting. It's terrible life. And I eventually did get a tenure track gig out at a very small state college in Georgia. And I taught there for about 5 years. But I taught English literature, British lit, about 1,000 years of British lit, everything from Beowulf to Milton, right? So Beowulf, Chaucer, Shakespeare, and all those folks in between. And then I taught a lot of writing as well as film. I taught film and comics and graphic novels. And this was the subject of my PhD. My focus was on medieval and Renaissance British literature, but also superhero comics and graphic novels.
That's kind of a range to be covering in one document.
It is, but that's what was great about it. It was the most fun dissertation to write ever. But you're right. It is quite a change. But the what I was trying to get at, and never ask a grad student about their dissertation. but what I was trying to get at was that these things are connected in ways that are maybe not obvious. And every person out there, everyone listening to this, who has read a lot of superhero comics, you don't know this, but you have been secretly trained to be an expert reader of medieval and Renaissance literature. Like all that crazy, wacky stuff that they do in those books, they also do in superhero comics, and you would get all of it. And it would be much easier for you to understand, actually, than a lot of other people out there. Anyway, so I had a lot of fun. I wrote a book,
what was your book about?
My book is called "Don't Buy It." This is me telling everybody who's listening: do not buy this book. I'm not here to pump my book, but
I'm just curious. That's all.
It's called "Superheroes of the Round Table: Comics Connections to Medieval and Renaissance Literature." It's got a whole chapter on Shakespeare and comics. It's got a bunch of work on there's like a survey of Arthurian themes in comics. There's a chapter on Jack Kirby's Fourth World and how it corresponds to plays in Shakespeare's time. And there's a whole chapter on Spenser's Faerie Queen, which is a book, Renaissance literature book, that's very dear to my heart. And then finally, Grant Morrison's various comics, Seven Soldiers of Victory and so on, gets a lot of treatment, The Invisibles and so on. Anyway, but it was actually that book helped me get a job, because the academic market for English professors is just terrible. Mm-hmm. So every job I applied for, there were 200 people applying for it, all with PhDs, all as qualified as I was. But I had published a book, right? So that put me on the top of the stack. And I loved the gig. I loved teaching. But the students were wonderful. But I was a really bad fit for rural Georgia. I'm a California guy. I'm about as liberal as it gets. And I'm not really a good fit for the kind of guns, God, and very conservative culture in rural Georgia. They're good people, but we just didn't agree on anything, right? So I was pretty unhappy, frankly. I was pretty isolated, had a hard time. I tried to run a group, and I have an old policy. Never game with anybody you wouldn't have over for dinner, mm-hmm. right? And it was really tough for me just to find a regular gaming group. So my friends had been after me to get out of academia for years. They said, look, you should just go into what you... Because I had also, all this time I had been doing freelance game writing and publishing. I had done some of it before the D20 boom, back in the old days. If we have any old school gamers out there, I'm from the original D&D basic set.
Yeah, me too.
That's my first D&D
set. When I first got that, the first set didn't even come with dice.
Oh, I had the old, I had those really ugly dice, like the you know, like the yellow four-sider famously bad. Those are my dice, and
that was a step up from what I we had strips of paper that you cut
up
and put in a cup,
in a cup to draw.
And then eventually we bought dice, and wow, this is so much easier.
Yeah, that's wild. Well, I had done some RPG publishing freelancing back in the old days, but then when the D20 license came out, and I realized that we could do it on our own anymore, that the gatekeepers no longer existed. I created TPK Productions, which is not the same. There's a company out right now called TPK, which is not the same company. So they're much bigger than I ever was. But I published a Mutants and Masterminds book and a D&D third edition adventure based on Julius Caesar, the old Shakespeare play. And I did a few things there. And over the years, I started to find a little bit of freelancing work. And this all kind of, a lot of that relationship was with Mike Lafferty at Fainting Goat Games and Chuck Rice, who at the time owned Vigilance Press. And I wrote a bunch of stuff, like for Icons, superhero role-playing game. And I created my own urban fantasy RPG called Arthur Lives.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that.
Well, most people aren't, so that's okay. But it's a fate, it uses fate core.
Okay, right.
And I worked years on that thing. I mean, I poured my heart and soul into that thing. And we did a Kickstarter and raised about $7,500, which was enough for me to hire Kara Hamilton, who did graphic design on Shadow of the Demon Lord. And she was amazing, and she made my book look fantastic on a budget, you know. Anyway, so I was really unhappy, and things were not going well. And so some friends suggested that I apply for other work. You know, it had never occurred to me to apply for work outside of academia. And 3 weeks later, I was on a bus to Seattle.
Wow.
You know, like it was that fast. And I said a bus, but in fact, I drove. So I got on as an editor here. And I think this is not, I'm not trying, this is not a claim to fame or anything, but it's more like a party joke. I think I am the only PhD at Paizo.
I don't know. I know you got a JD.
We have a couple of people with master's degrees. We have a lot of, we have several grad students, including my former boss, Judy, at the editor's desk. And like I say, this does not make me definitely better than anybody else. In fact, like I say, it's mostly just the thing that it makes me different than every other Jason in the room.
Right.
You know, that's just kind of my thing. But I started at the editor desk. And I was there for a year and a half working with amazing people on a fantastic team. And I came on right when we were starting to do the playtest, editing for the playtest. And it was a hell of an experience. I mean, I was at my desk for 2 hours, and I got handed the latest adventure of War for the Crown. And it was like, okay, here's War for the Crown. Do your best. Right. Talk about learning on the job.
Yeah, so I was wondering, you have a couple of Pathfinder 2nd Edition things that you've published as well. And so the playtest experience probably helped you get up on the rule set even before
that's right.
It was finalized.
I've had this huge benefit of seeing how the rules evolved as I was working at the company. And my first real big breakout project here at Paizo was Starfinder Adventure Path 18, which is Attack on the Crucible. That's the last adventure in Dawn of Flame.
Yeah, which we're very excited, we're a ways away. So Jake has offered to run it for our podcast group.
I am.
Very excited about
that. I would love
to.
But Chris Sims, who was the developer of that AP, he gave me a chance on that. And to his great credit and to my my eternal gratitude. But then I was in, so the editors have a policy where we like to attach one of our editors to every new project to sort of work as a liaison between the editorial department and every other department, right?
Okay.
So when a bunch of people met to decide what the next AP for Pathfinder was going to be after the first AP, the second, so what was the first one called? Wrath of Dragons or something like that?
Age of Ashes.
Age of Ashes. So when we knew that Age of Ashes was going to wrap up, but we didn't know what was going to be the next AP. So I'm sitting in a room with Ron Lundeen and Stephen Madden McFarland, and I'm the editorial liaison. And they start throwing ideas around, And Eric's like, well, we should get some people on this that haven't written a piece before. We should make a concerted effort, because we did almost all in-house authors for Age of Ashes.
Oh, okay, right.
So we've used all the vets, but let's make an outreach attempt on the second one. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I've never written an adventure path.
Okay.
And so because I was in the meeting,
right,
I could go to Ron and say, put my name in. Mm-hmm. And he walked over to my desk an hour later and said, which one do you want to write?
Wow.
Right? So being able to be in on the meetings and learning the system as we were all working on it was a huge, huge asset.
And you're a Starfinder developer primarily?
I am.
And so be able to cross over to...
Well, I was only an editor at the time.
Oh, at the time, right, okay.
And editors read everything.
Right.
Right? Like editors do everything from flip mats and pawn collections to the PaizoCon brochure. I mean, we do it. We read everything goes past us. Right. And because the editorial team has a policy of doing multiple passes on everything, and we need a new set of eyes every time, that means most of the editors read most of the products.
How much of that do you actually retain then, having to read so much?
You're immersed in it, right? Like, you don't have a choice to it. You have to retain it.
Yeah.
But it is a challenge, because we were doing we were still putting out P1 products. We're doing playtest, and then we were still doing Starfinder. So we had to have three different game systems in our head at the same time. And moving to Starfinder, as I did, last Gen Con, right? So I got final word of the promotion like 2 days before we all got on a plane to Milwaukee or to Indianapolis. So that was so that I could be introduced and talk to people at the con as a Starfinder developer. And I could start networking. And when freelancers, aspiring writers come to us, I could talk to them as a developer who could hire them rather than as an editor who's just kind of giving editorial advice.
So which projects do you work on for Starfinder now? What do you develop for them?
Well, I work with Keeley on the adventure paths.
Okay. Like
that's so...
makes sense you two sit together.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the reasons why I had to go to Jake. Now, Jake is like my family nickname, like my parents, my siblings. Everybody calls me Jake in the family. My cousins and aunts and uncles and everybody. But I've never used it normally in my regular day-to-day life. And I struggled here for the first year and a half or so, and I was just one of three Jasons. Right. But now I am literally sitting next to another Jason. And so I was going crazy. Like, so I had to think of something. So anyway, I trade off with Keeley on all of the material in the adventure path. So right now, he's developing the adventures and I do the back matter for the tail end of the Threefold Conspiracy.
Right.
And the one we're doing next after that, which I don't believe has been announced yet.
Has not, no.
So I'm doing a back matter article for the first part of that today as we speak. Then I am outlining and assigning and developing the next adventure path after that one.
Oh.
Which is all my idea.
Nice.
So I got to pitch three or four different ideas. To Rob McCreary and Keeley, and we talked about it amongst ourselves, and we picked the one I really wanted to do anyway, so that's good. And
Is that the one that Ron is doing the final book for?
No.
Okay.
Ron is working on the one after Threefold Conspiracy.
Right. Okay.
But I'm talking about the one after that.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And we haven't announced it or talked anything about it at all.
Nothing.
But it's been incredibly exciting to work on. And so I outlined it, and our outlines for an AP are about 25, 30 pages. And it breaks down all of the adventures and a lot of general topics that cover everything. And we hired writers for all of those adventures. And I expect manuscripts to start coming in this week.
Wow, cool.
So I'm going to have a lot of Christmas reading to do.
Oh, you got to take time off. You can't read all that on Christmas.
But, you know, like, when there are few things more pleasurable than writing an outline for an adventure and then seeing what the freelancer turned in and did with that outline. Like, that's just so wonderful.
So I kind of, as an academic myself, I kind of wonder about the process of outlining an adventure path and filling it out, how that compares to drafting an academic paper where you build have Bill to Bones and Bill to Supporting Arguments and things like that.
Yeah. Well,
what's the comparison like on that?
You know, I find that actually I've done so – I mean, when I was hired here, I had 40 RPG credits. So I tend to for me, it's almost the opposite. I almost do my academic papers more like game supplements than the other way around.
Right.
But the main advantage that my academic career has brought to my work as a developer is my emphasis on providing author feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Because as an English professor, that's all I do is grade essays all day.
Yes.
Right? And so now as a developer, I'm not grading and I'm not the feedback is different. But our freelance writers are a resource that we want to grow and nurture so that they can turn in more for us and better. More manuscripts and better manuscripts. And that will reduce our developing time later. I mean, if someone has a recurring problem in their writing, but they can solve that problem, that means I don't have to fix it anymore the next time they turn one in, right? And so I try to bring my academic experience to that. As far as outlining goes and the transition from outlining to the turn-in manuscript, you know, it's really about letting the author do their thing. You know, you kind of give them an outline that has the key plot or story elements or maybe a particular scene that you really want to be in there. And then kind of let them do their thing. I actually learned this from my cousin. My cousin, Brian Frankish, is a... assistant director in Hollywood. And I remember him telling me, like, just you got to let the artist do what they do best, you know? And I try and do that. And it's still a process for me. I haven't been a developer for that long. I've only developed back matter materials so far. I haven't had a big adventure project to go over. But I'm trying to get to a point where I let the author's voice stay as much as possible and only rewrite or revise when I have to. But figuring out when you have to, that's the challenge.
And you don't go back to the author again. I mean, once they've
submitted. That's a very good question. We can. In theory, we can.
Right.
But we almost never do because there's almost never time.
Right.
However, I do ask questions to the authors because we have their emails. So I can be like, well, I don't really know what you meant with this sentence. Like, what were you going for? And that's usually why I ask questions is what was your goal here? What were you trying to do? And let me help get to that point better, right? But we communicate a lot as the project is being written. We create Discord channels and servers for every project. So the back and forth, the questions and answers on this unannounced adventure path have been very, very good. They've helped the project get better because writers have had really good questions or maybe push a little bit at where something maybe could be better. And we've all been able to get in and make it better.
That's great.
Yeah.
So writing for both second edition and Starfinder, writing scenarios, APs, and for rule books, how does that process differ across all these platforms and things?
So I was doing The Show Must Go On, which is the first adventure in the AP. And I wasn't originally going to write the first one. I actually asked to write the second one because I believe that levels 3 to 5 are like the golden age for gaming. So I wanted to write a level 5 adventure so I could use fireballs. but at the last minute, Ron came to me and said that the author they had originally intended to do the first one couldn't do it for scheduling reasons. Could I move to the first one? And this is literally while we were in the middle of doing editing for second edition. So it was like the worst possible time. I'm spending, we're doing all weekends for 3 months.
Wow.
To get Pathfinder second edition out the door. And then I'm running home at night and working 4 hours on this adventure.
Because that's freelance work.
You can't do that in the office.
Yeah.
Exactly. But your question about like how is it different? We didn't have a treasure system. treasure allocation for second edition when I wrote that. I mean, it wasn't done yet.
So you didn't know what it was going to be like.
I didn't know everything. Oh, wow. So I would have to write Ron things like, okay, well, maybe there are some scrolls in here because he's a wizard. So, or, you know, and he knew, he understood that. So he knew that a lot of revisions would take place.
Right.
So I basically wrote the adventure using the playtest rules.
Right.
And then there were all these changes. But to second edition's credit, it was not as hard of a rewrite as it might otherwise be. Because, for example, I'm going to get specific here. Second edition, Pathfinder second edition, does not require you to make monsters with the same mechanics that you make player characters.
Oh.
Right?
Okay. I don't do a lot of Pathfinder.
Okay, but you've done Starfinder.
Yes.
Okay, well, you know.
And I know the mechanics are different.
Okay,
yes.
Actually, this is the point where they're the same. That's my point. When you make an alien in Starfighter, when you make a monster, you just use a table. And, like, its hit points and its AC.
Right.
All determined. Well, see, that's what Pathfinder 2nd Edition also does.
Okay.
Right? So, I could just describe a monster, and I could write up a monster.
Oh.
And even though a lot of the Pathfinder rules had changed, like the character creation rules had changed, the monster didn't change.
Right.
Sweet! That was good. So, It was an experience, but Ron was very patient, and he knew that there'd be a lot of development that had to happen. That's why he told me, he's like, okay, the day that your adventure is due, I need to have it that day. Because I need to have as much development time as possible. It needs to be there on Monday. And I was like, okay, I swear to God, it's going to be there on Monday.
Was it there on Monday?
It was.
All right, good.
It was.
I hear that's really important.
It is really important. And working on Starfinder, but now that I'm no longer in the editor team, I can forget about a lot of the stuff that I had to remember before, like Pathfinder First Edition. We don't do P1 anymore, so I don't have to remember that anymore.
Right.
And I can focus on the game that I am working on all the time.
How do you like that? How do you like Starfinder compared to Pathfinder Second Edition? I mean, they're similar in some ways, but it's a lot different.
They are different. Yeah. There's obvious differences that everybody talks about.
I mean, beyond
about.
The setting, too.
The three-action economy of P2 is the thing that everybody talks about.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I almost kind of wish we had that in Starfinder.
Well, you know, I don't want to say anything, but that does seem to be the overall opinion I've heard from players of the game, that they like it. I love both games, but science fantasy is a wonderfully creative genre for me. One of the first things I did, and your listeners may find this helpful or interesting, I don't know, but as soon as I arrived here in Seattle, I started a Starfinder home game with a home setting, the homebrew setting.
Oh, cool.
Because I had all these creative ideas I wanted to do, and I wanted to get on the Star Chamber. I wanted to get on the Starfinder team. Well, what's the best way to get on the Starfinder team? To be a Starfinder developer already.
Right.
So So I would use my home game to play test my own new rule options, like new classes and new spells and new monsters and stuff. And then I published those on my own to DriveThru RPG, so that when it came time for me to get an interview, I could say I'm already doing the job.
Right.
I could show that I already published Starfinder stuff on my own.
Yeah, you had mentioned that when I had talked to you last week.
Oh, yeah.
About just every day writing, publishing, and doing stuff. And I actually interviewed Alex Agunis, who kind of talked about the same thing.
Absolutely.
Where, he had lots of ideas. He just publishes them.
That's right.
And it's like, wow, you're showing you're doing the job. That's like the perfect way to show I can do the job because I'm already doing it.
This is the same thing that I would tell students when they wanted to know why do they have to do a senior thesis.
Right.
Because that's the whole point, is that whatever job you want to do, you do it now.
Right.
And then you go to the application room or the interview room and you say, look, I'm already doing the job.
Yep.
Right. Anyway, So I love Starfinder because it gives me a chance to homage all of my favorite science fiction and science fantasy books like Dune. And my Starfinder campaign was basically Game of Thrones in space. It was like this massive interstellar empire that was totally different than Pact Worlds, right? It was like this ancient 5,000-year-long empire dominated by humans, not as multi-species as Pact Worlds is. And spaceship travel was totally different than the Drift, and everything was very, very different. But I did that on purpose, so that I could create ideas and publish stuff that wouldn't fit in Pact Worlds. the things I was creating were sort of they wouldn't fit in the traditional Starfinder setting, which is the whole point of publishing them.
But you still use the rule set, so you
use the rule set,
exactly. Under the open gaming license.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Well, anyway, and I haven't had a chance to run P2 yet. Mm-hmm. But I like the game. I mean, I worked on it. Mm-hmm. I was an editor the whole process, mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful game. I love the work that Luis and Eleanor mm-hmm. And everybody is doing on those books is amazing. And I've been able to write some for it. I did some writing on the Advanced Player's Guide and mm-hmm. That hasn't come out yet. And so it's been fun.
So, to what extent does your writing experience help inform your developing experience?
That's a good question. Let me think about it for a minute. Here's a tip. Whenever anybody says that's a good question, that's them stalling for time.
Yes.
Well, I know how important deadlines are mm-hmm. because I know a developer can be really put out. But I also know that there's some flexibility. Like, have a good relationship with your developer. That's what it's taught me. Mm-hmm. Because I can go to a developer. If I'm a developer and somebody says, I need a week, I know if I can give them a week, right? And if I can, I do. And if I can't, I can't. Mm-hmm. So communicate. Don't be afraid to communicate. That's been a huge deal. But it's also helped me learn a lot of the things that we do here at Paizo that aren't grammar or mechanical issues, but are more just like the things that Paizo likes to do and the things that we try to avoid, kind of house style.
Like some examples?
Yeah. Let me try to give some. So for example, there are some elements like Easter eggs. Okay, so everybody that's writing an adventure right. likes to bury like their right. favorite Easter eggs in there. Name characters after people they like from fiction, or name a bad guy after someone you really don't like, right? Okay, you can't do that.
I tried to squeeze some things in like that when I was writing for the Starship Operation Manual.
Okay.
And Compton said, we really can't use that Kessel word. It's really pretty popular.
Exactly. I'll give, this is an accidental example, but if you remember from the Starship Operations Manual, mm-hmm. there's a new officer role for, I think it's called the Chief Mate or something.
Right, right.
Well, originally we were going to call that the Master Chief.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Okay, you can't call it the Master Chief, right?
Do that. Yeah.
So, as a developer, I've learned a lot of those things that you can't do. Easter eggs just being one example. And also, I've learned, writing adventure paths is a real challenge because players want a flexible story. They don't want to be railroaded.
Right.
But we don't have time to cover options and alternate paths. Mm-hmm. If you can't use every page of an adventure path, a customer might think they got ripped off. Like, there's a whole chapter here we didn't use. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's no good. Like, so we have to give choices, but sometimes it's more like an illusion of choice, mm-hmm. right? The players, and this is all about consent, like the players and the GM all agree to play the adventure kind of as it was written. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean you can't change it. Everybody changes it. I know. Right. I haven't run a D&D adventure ever that I haven't seriously rewritten from the ground up, mm-hmm. right? Like, that's just what you do. But in many ways, I have to just kind of assume that GMs are going to do that mm-hmm. and let them do it. And I'm just going to write the adventure the way we have it outlined. And I'm not going to be able to accommodate every possible weird, crazy thing your players do. That's on you.
Yeah, I see sometimes it says, if the players skip this, or if this encounter didn't happen, then this NPC shows up here.
Yes.
A couple things like that.
Yes, but see, what that is troubleshooting. That's
right, because
like,
you still need that, the backstory
exactly
part
what
of it
is.
For something
yes.
else.
If the players don't find this clue, how do we get them to part three?
Right.
And the answer is somebody shows up and gives them a clue, or gives them another clue that gets them to the same spot.
Yeah, sometimes as GMing through the APs, if I don't see that hook, I have to go back and dig through it to make sure, this is that one little piece of information they need to tie it together. I got to make sure this comes out. So you've already shared some advice you've had for people, but do you have any other advice for people interested in writing for RPGs, Paizo or otherwise?
Okay, well, so the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to get you a link, because I literally wrote an entire article about this. It's called How I Got My Job in Gaming.
There you go.
And I will send you a link, and you can show it to your readers.
Sure.
And I hope that it's on Fifth World, the Fifth World blog mm-hmm. that I occasionally contribute to. But yes, I can absolutely share what advice I can. The first thing is we've already talked about, do it yourself. Like the best way to do the work is to to show that you can do the work is to already do it. There's nothing stopping you from writing an adventure. It's hard. Nothing's stopping you except a ton of work, right? To write an adventure or a bunch of spells or magic items or whatever you want to do and publish it on your own through DriveThruRPG. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't even have to sell that much. Like, you know, my best-selling product has sold like 500 copies. You know, like
that's actually really good.
It's not about sales.
Right.
It's about showing that you've learned the lessons that you will learn by outlining and developing and editing and doing art direction for a 10-page
project. So when I was getting my doctorate, doing dissertation, one of the things that people would tell you is this isn't your best work. This is just your first here.
Yes.
Just showing that you can do the process.
That's right.
And you learn from there. And
that's
so I'd say similar you're just doing it to learn the process, showing that you can start it, go through and finish it, and hopefully you'll improve from there.
And you do learn from there. You make contacts. Pretty soon you start hiring professional artists and professional layout people. Mm-hmm. And now you can add art direction and development to your resume. And pretty soon, so yes, do it yourself. Second thing, and this is really hard for people to hear. You have to live in Seattle. I know that sounds crazy.
Wait, for any game?
Not for any game, but
if you're D&D or
Bizo, if you want a full time job. Yeah. In the gaming business.
Oh, full-time, right.
Not freelancer.
Right.
If you want to be a full-time gaming professional, here's the thing. I did not originally get the job in editorial. I interviewed, and I was the second choice. But they offered the job to someone else, and they couldn't move to Seattle.
Wow.
And then they called me and said, the job is yours if you want it. And because I could pick up everything and move, I got the gig. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't other companies elsewhere.
Right.
There are. But it's like if you want to be on stage, you move to Broadway. And if you want to be in films, you go to Hollywood. I mean, you can do it elsewhere, but it's 10 times harder. Mm-hmm. What doesn't matter is knowing people. You don't have to know people. I didn't know anybody in this building.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Jacob Blackman, who knew Owen. So I had a friend of a friend.
Right.
But otherwise, I didn't know anybody. I had almost never played a Paizo product.
Right. Well, you were coming to edit, so...
It's not about your knowledge of one game system.
Right.
Because a good developer, a good creator in the gaming business, knows a lot of games.
Mm-hmm.
That's what informs them.
Right.
They can learn any game system because they know many already.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you don't have to be a master on the particular game. But you should have a lot of experience with a lot of games. A broad knowledge is more important than deep knowledge of one system. And you don't need to know people. Your work will get you the interview.
So how do you demonstrate your expertise as an editor, though?
Right. Well, okay.
So that's a little different. You don't have work.
So I got the interview based on my 40 published RPG credits.
Okay.
And my PhD in English.
Right.
Because I could honestly tell them, editing is what I do all day.
Yeah, PhD in English seems like it.
You don't have to have a PhD. Anybody who has taught English classes, and, master's graduate students of all types do that.
Right.
That's how they pay their bills, is adjunct.
For sure.
But that got me the interview. No, that got me the test. We have a test here at Paizo.
Oh.
We have every job, the development, editing, design, all of them have tests created by the managers of the department. So I filled out the application, they read my resume, they said, would you like to take the editorial test? And it was about 8 pages long.
Wow.
With like a couple of spells, some feats, some magic items, monsters, because editing stat blocks is a huge pain in the ass.
Right.
And a couple of encounters from an organized play scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And it was bad. It was all messed up. Like they didn't
And they give you the style guideline
And see, here's the thing. That you think, well, 8 pages, that doesn't sound too bad. Because the style guide for Paizo at the time was 84 pages.
Yeah. Wow.
And it's gotten bigger.
Wow.
It's only gotten bigger since then. So it wasn't the 8 pages that were hard. It was the 85 pages that you had to make the 8 pages look like.
Right.
Right?
Right. Wow.
So then you had 48 hours, I think, or 72 hours for the editorial test. So I just cleared off the whole table, and I didn't do anything else for 3 days besides eat, sleep, and work on my editorial test. And then I submitted the test, and there that's a show your work test. So not only do you fix everything, but you explain why it's wrong.
Right.
Wow. Right? And then they file everybody's names off of the editorial test, all identifying markers. And then once it's been made anonymous, it's shopped around to all of the editors, and they decide who they like best. And they interview based on the test.
Wow.
Okay.
That's actually really cool.
It is. It's a really great experience. Yeah. And we had one for editing, and then there's also one. So I had to do another one when I was applied for the Star Chamber as a developer. So I had a development test. And when Liz Liddell went from editing to design, she had to pass a design test, right? And this is how we filter people so that we don't just hire... Look, everybody wants to hire their friends.
Right.
Right. But you can't do that. Like that's not the best thing.
Right.
Who's the best at the job? And then when you do interviews, you can figure out if they're work well with the team.
Mm-hmm. Right? Wow, very cool, very cool.
Yeah.
So what's next for you? You know,
What's next for me?
What's coming that you can talk about?
Yeah. So that's an interesting question because I actually have kind of been asking myself that over the last few weeks. Everybody here at Paizo does a lot of freelancing, also for Paizo. And after I turned in Starfinder Adventure Path 27, which is Deceiver's Moon, I think, I had some freelance obligations. I did an adventure for The After, which is a post-apocalyptic alien invasion game using the Savage World setting.
Okay.
For John Gibbons' book, and I did some stuff for us for like the APG and things like that. But I have slowly worked off almost all of my freelancing obligations. So I have a very unusual moment right now, which I actually don't have anything I have to do. And this has made me look and ask myself, what do I want to do?
Mm-hmm.
Because here's the lesson. This is what I learned. And my book, my academic book, and my stuff for Starfinder, I called it the Empire Arcane, was my Starfinder original setting, the Empire Arcane. That Empire Arcane stuff will probably never see print. My book, I make like 50 cents off of every copy of that book.
Right.
Like it's not about making the money.
Yeah.
The book, the setting, the point of them is not themselves. The point is to get me to another goal.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote the book to get a job in academia, and it worked. Mm-hmm. I didn't write the book to write the book.
Right.
I wrote the book to become a professor. I made Empire Arcane to get on the Star Chamber, right? It worked. And now I have to think, what do I want to do next?
Where do you want to go?
That's a very good question. Wow. Now, I love being a developer, and I thought about it long and hard because there's always a lot of opportunity at Paizo.
Mm-hmm.
People don't stay here forever. I didn't have to apply for a developer job. I could have waited for another opportunity somewhere else. But I talked to developers, I talked to designers, I talked to editors, and I knew that that was the gig I wanted to have.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have it, and now I want to just kick ass at it, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I've got this new adventure path that I'm working on. I'm incredibly excited about it. It's very personal. And I want it to say things that we haven't said before. I want it to do things. When I pitched the idea to Rob, he described it as ambitious and bold, right? Well, that's exactly what I want. I want it to be something that's totally unlike anything else. And it's going to take me a year to get it out,
right?
Like, it's not going to come out until like November,
mm-hmm.
a year from now. So that's my next year. I'm going to be living, eating, drinking, and breathing that thing every hour that I'm here at the office. But then, what do I want to do when I'm home? What do I want to work on my free time? It's a very good question. I don't know yet.
If you ever want to do some gaming, I have a couple groups here.
That's fantastic. I would love to do that. I would love to play.
I know you play at Ron's already playing Torg.
I do. I play in Ron's Torg game. I play like a Rocketeer guy, which I love because he is like the dumbest guy in the party. He's the door kicker, and I love it. And I GM Ars Magica.
Mm,
I don't know if most people don't know what Ars Magica is. It was originally created in the 80s by a couple of people named Jonathan Tweet and Mark Reinhagen, whom you will recognize, right? And Ars Magica is set in a fantastic version of 13th century Europe. So it's Europe. Right. It's England and France and Spain. And
so it has a historical basis and then...
But it's magical. But everything that the people thought were true is true.
Okay.
Right? So it's just a mythical version of medieval Europe. And it's famous for its magic system. And I run that game every week with a group of wonderful players. And maybe I'll write something for that game. I kind of want to do a beginner's box.
Mm-hmm.
We did a Starfighter beginner box, of course, and that experience was incredibly educational. Mm-hmm. I was only an editor at the time, but it's really made me realize how important a good starter set can be. And you and I started this conversation by talking about our first basic set. That game, that's what got me into gaming, man. Yeah. Like that basics, and for all of its imperfections, and it had them. Right? Like you said, you didn't even have dice in the first set. For all of their imperfections, they are the yellow brick road into our hobby.
Right.
And I really want to make one. I want to make one so bad. And I have no right to do it for any other game because I don't have the license to any other game. But I'm thinking about doing it anyway and just pitching it to the company and saying, here, I made you a
How
beginner
can they
box.
Say no?
And if nothing else, I mean, I'll learn. I'll learn a lot because it's so hard to do one of those things. So much work. So maybe that's what I'll do.
Well, Jason, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. I look forward to seeing you again, hopefully at PaizoCon.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah. I'll be running Empire Arcane.
Yeah. And maybe at other conventions to go to other conventions.
I am going to Recon, which I think is in... I can't remember. University in Ohio.
Oh, somewhere. Yeah. I saw that in Toledo.
That's it. Toledo. I'll be going to Recon and giving a little talk and running, doing some Starfinder chat. They have a game design program out there. And, of course, I'll be at Gen Con because we all go to Gen Con.
Excellent.
But, yeah, it was a real privilege to be here, and I'd love to come back anytime.
Great. Thanks.